Brian Stemme with BioCrossroads, and this Frameworks is going to be talking about two of the really coolest companies that you haven't heard of, at least many of us haven't heard of locally. Before I get started, I wanted to thank you, say a couple thank yous to our sponsors, Butler University, Miles Printing, which has published the booklets, as well as Indie Science Connect, and I'll come back to them at the end. Really want to thank Butler University because they are making this space available to us. It's great, very casual, very friendly. Enjoy it. Easy to get to the parking, easy to get here. You know, Butler is going to be making some announcements over the next year about the they're building a new science building as well as expanding the and renovating the two buildings that they have. Very exciting. There are hundreds of graduates in biology and chemistry that come out every year. Many of those go to graduate school, many of those end up coming into industry directly with some of the companies that you probably work at. So really want to, I'm a Butler grad, so it's easy for me to come up here and pump them up, but it really is going to be exciting stuff. It's going to look something like the building right next to here, the business building. It's going to be exciting stuff, and you'll hear more about that as we head towards the fall. So let me go ahead and get started real quick. First, what we're going to do real quickly is I'm going to run through some metrics that we keep each year and try to maintain so we can look at comparisons from year to year. Then I'll give a little bit of background about our guests. I'll have both Mike and Scott. We'll talk about their companies a little bit, and then we'll have some Q&A at the end. So let me go ahead and get started here. Let's see. Okay. Let's see. I want to make sure. There we go. And back. Great. I think a couple things before we get to the metrics that we published a few weeks ago. I think it's important to just, again, highlight some of the things that are going on. BioCrossroads' job is to monitor this stuff. We know you guys have your own day jobs and are doing many other things. So just to kind of aggregate a few, this is probably the last 18 months that we've seen these going on. You know, we've had both OrthoPediatrics as well as Elanco going public. You know, excitingly, we've seen several companies with big announcements on how they're going to be expanding. You know, Catalent had an article a few weeks ago talking about moving from roughly 800 to almost 1,200 people in the old Cook Pharmica facility. I think you've read about Endocyte had an amazing buyout from Novartis. They're really focused on that technology, and what an amazing turnaround they had in over about a two-year period. So I think it's good just to refresh the memory. You guys are doing other things. There probably could be another 10 up here that are interesting, but just trying to highlight a few. So looking at the stats for this year, we're going to go through three or four slides here. The exciting part about this is that, again, Indiana, as you may have heard, we have a real – our advantage is having both a breadth and a depth of life sciences. So if we look at Indiana and we compare it to other states that are very strong, if you look at Boston, very strong in biotech, very strong in med device, but not a lot of ag tech, not a lot of biologistics. In some cases, they have certain types of testing labs, quite a few. But we're lucky in that we have really depth in all the five areas of what bio tracks, pharma, med device, research and testing labs, biologistics, and ag tech, if I didn't say that one, ag chemicals. We have kind of an unusual situation this year in that all of our stats went up. The Indiana Business Research Center helps us put these stats together. And what they've done is, this is mostly 2008, some 2017, based on the best information that we can get. Typically, we're going to have variations in venture capital or products that get developed and launched. That's is variance based on just how the industry is going, just the vagaries of things. But all of our salaries, our wages, the number of companies, it happens to be this year venture capital and company formation was up. So it's exciting because we don't see that every number goes up. You know, we will typically have variation in many of those. And I guess the summary point I would take away from this slide is that we've got a really strong industry, and there's continuing to be opportunities for growth. So venture capital is a topic that we get quite a bit of, and I would be a person that says you can never have enough money. So these are good stats, but we want them to be better. As you can see, this is 6 years, and we've generally had, I think we've had three out of the last 5 years, over $100 million. The good news is having those sizable numbers, but in many cases, as you probably know, one or two deals can make up almost the entire amount. And that just depends on, again, when companies want to raise money. I try to explain to the paper every year when these numbers come out, you know, these numbers are not linear. We hope they're higher than lower, but it really just depends on when the companies need to raise the money to advance their programs. And they're certainly not going to issue any, they're going to have any venture investment unless they have to avoid the dilution. I think the one thing that's not shown on this slide, if you were to look at the previous 6 years, very significantly smaller numbers. I think the first year I was at BioCrossroads, we were somewhere between 5 and 7 million total for the state. So again, headed in the right direction. We need to get more. BioCrossroads and other people are doing things to try to work on that. I guess what I would say, taking away from this, is I'm encouraged by the number of companies that are getting investment, even if those investments can be modest at times, $100,000, $500,000. That's the beginning of a company that you'll see later today. So looking over the last 10 years, let's see what we got. Okay, did I go one too far? Nope. Okay. So really what we've got here is this is looking at 10 years of data from a perspective of salaries, jobs, but then salaries is in both life sciences as well as the total private sector. So the thing that's interesting about this is it looks, you know, and job growth is relatively flat for the last 10 years. And that has good points and bad points. The bad news is we've had changes in some of the bigger companies that have either consolidated in Warsaw like DePue, Zimmer and Biomet have had some job decreases. We know Lilly has changed their business model to do some things differently. But when you see those decreases, it's a little depressing. But then that's offset by large increases at places like Covance, Cook Pharmica, which is now Catalent, I had a couple others in my head, but don't have them now. I think I had listed out that we had 4 or 5 companies in the last 7 or 8 years that have hired 500 people or more. So again, certain things changing, both positive and negative. In the end, in this case, we'd love it to be growing very fast, but in this case, I think that being able to stay on track is actually a good thing given the industry pressure, consolidation, and some of the things that our companies face. Again, the wage growth has been modest over the last 10 years, but we still have a very healthy sector from an average wage perspective over the total private wage, which is in the orange bar there. So last slide for me is talking about, continued strength for Indiana is our manufacturing portion of our life sciences. You know, we really are very good, and we're lucky that we have companies that do both their R&D and manufacturing in the state. If you can see from the back here, we've shown pretty sizable increases in exports over the last decade, along with the U.S., but, you know, we have, as a manufacturing-intensive state, shown more growth. And the thing I would take away from this is that, you know, as we have manufacturing, as you know, it's got a higher multiplier effect, and again, that's going to hopefully drive some additional job growth. Of these numbers, so roughly of $10.2 billion for 17, 70% is pharma, 24% is medical devices, and 6% is ag chemicals and feedstocks. Okay, so I've got a few minutes left here, but I'd like to go ahead and some introductions here real quick. So first of all, before I call up our speakers today, I think the reason that we put this together was it's really exciting to see these two companies, Acacia and Outpost, doing things here. You know, the exciting part is these are individuals as management that have worked both here in Indianapolis and on the West Coast, but have come back here to start their companies, start or continue building an operation. They're doing it here. They're hiring talent here. And they're really, the excitement around these to me is that you're looking at two companies that might end up being the next Indesight or the next Acacia, the next Assembly. And so it's exciting to see these companies that are here. They're developing products, one early stage, one late stage. And so that's what excites me, and the fact that these guys are working so hard, they're underneath the radar. We've learned more about them I've got some really exciting things to talk about. So I'm really glad to be able to be up here and working with them. Real quickly, our first speaker, I'm going to introduce both of them. It's going to be Mike Bolander. You can see his background as well as Scott's background in the program, so I won't spend a lot of time. Mike has significant experience at Lilly and Cadence Pharmaceuticals out in San Diego and later Mallinckrodt before coming back here to run Acacia's U.S. commercial operations. Scott Bird, who you'll hear from later, again, lots of experience at Lilly, went out to a senior position at Cadence also, and then was at Mallinckrodt for a little while before coming back to work both at Acacia and then help found Outpost, which has got just a terrific set of investors and really bright prospects. So without further ado, let me introduce Mike Bolander, who is the Chief Commercial Officer for Acacia Pharma.
Good morning. I'll have to admit that I doubt I know most of you. So as Brian said, my name's Mike Bolander. If you knew me, you probably wouldn't have come out to hear this today. So I recognize that. So I appreciate the fact that we haven't met. I want to talk to you a little bit today about Acacia Pharma, the company that I'm at right now, as well as the disease state that we're about to launch our first drug into, and that first drug, Barhemsys. A lot of people say, how do you say it? Barhemsys, like Barhemsys. So Acacia Pharma, a little bit about us. We're a hospital pharmaceutical group that is focused right now on bringing assets to market to treat postoperative nausea and vomiting, as well as chemo-induced nausea and vomiting. And I apologize up front that we'll talk a little bit about nausea and vomiting right after you've probably just had breakfast. As unpleasant as that is, that's the business I work in. So we've identified We identified a couple of candidates that are based on the same active ingredient, amisulpride, and our company was founded and the headquarters are located in Cambridge, UK, but our U.S. operations are, spoiler, yeah, I think that's why you're here, right, here in Indianapolis. Here you can see an overview of our pipeline for these two molecules. We've got one, it says filing approval, so I think we probably have it on here. If not, you'll see it several times. We are waiting next Friday, not this Friday, but next Friday with bated breath as we're expecting to hear back from the FDA on our approval situation and very excited about that and have a lot more work in front of us, as you can imagine. Thought I'd show you some mugshots of the executive team, led by our founder and CEO, Julian Gilbert, our CFO, Christine Soden, our chief medical officer, Gabriel Fox, all of those very brilliant, well-spoken, articulate folks with beautiful accents all live in England, and it's just me over here. Our quick snapshot of our current U.S. organization, and I was talking to somebody here earlier. The funny thing is, gosh, 13 months ago, it was me. I was like, Scott had left me, as you could hear from our introductions. We had similar paths, right? I just keep following, holding on to his coattails everywhere. And he had left to go work at Outpost, and it was just me in the U.S. And from that, 13 months ago, we've got 40 of us here, 40 positions in the U.S., 15 of which are based here in Indianapolis. The rest are either field-based or are commuting virtually. Talk to you a little bit about the disease state. So, first of all, it's very common for folks to have postoperative nausea and vomiting. I would ask, anybody experience this post-surgically? Yeah, I can see quite a few hands. If you ever have, you know that it's probably one of the worst experiences, certainly of that surgical period. It's unpleasant and obviously associated with discomfort and a lot of dissatisfaction, which is dollars and cents in today's hospital world. Patient dissatisfaction is something they try to avoid. Believe it or not, if you've never had this, it may be surprising. If you've had this, it's not surprising. Patients are more concerned about feeling nausea and vomiting postoperatively than they are about their post-surgical pain, and we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a few minutes. It is very common, as I said. It'll occur in up to, somehow I think I'm advancing this unintentionally. It'll occur in up to 80% of high-risk patients, but despite the fact that surgeons and anesthesiologists will give drugs prophylactically to try to prevent it, it still occurs in about a third of patients. Despite having prophylaxis, it's still advancing. I don't know what's going on. And I promise I'm not touching it, Erica. Anyway, it does, and it can lead to unanticipated inpatient stays as well as delay the discharge from hospital, and therefore increases costs. Here you can see it increases stay in something we call PACU, post-anesthesia care unit, or a lot of us call it the recovery room. That's important for a couple reasons. One, the PACU is a highly intensive care area of the hospital, and so it's very expensive to have patients in there, but it's also a gate, if you will, for surgery throughput. So they can't bring someone into the OR suite, which is the moneymaker for the hospital, right? They can't bring someone into that OR suite if they don't have a bed for them in PACU. And so as patients get backed up or clog up that PACU, it becomes a real rate limiter for that throughput in the surgical suite. Patients, I think there might be a build on this, but no, maybe not. Patients actually, as I said earlier, they care more about post-operative nausea and vomiting than they do about the pain. If you look here, you can see these mountains that represent how much they care about that pain. I don't know what's going on with my slides. But anyway, you can see the red of this circle is the concern about post-operative nausea and vomiting of patients. The next biggest is that gray circle, which is their post-operative pain. So they care almost twice as much about post-operative nausea and vomiting as they do about their pain. And again, that's important for hospitals because of patient satisfaction. There are also clinical complications that can arise due to post-operative nausea and vomiting. Imagine you've just had an upper GI surgery, maybe a bariatric surgery or a acid reflux surgery, and all of a sudden now you're dry heaving, you're retching and vomiting. You can do a lot of damage to the surgical site. You can look at wound dehiscence as well as venous hypertension, electrolyte imbalances, all kinds of negative things that actually can occur from post-operative nausea and vomiting. A lot of people think, who cares if they get sick after surgery? Actually, it does matter. It matters a lot. It matters to patients, as we said. So it's a complex system. I'm not going to walk through all this because I won't claim to understand it that well, right? There's a lot of medical folks in the audience, and they'd call me out. It's a complex system. It involves multiple systems within the body and obviously is mediated both, I say obviously like everybody would know, it's mediated both centrally and peripherally. And there are a lot of neurotransmitters and receptors that mediate this, what we call the CTZ, or as my colleagues in the UK call the CTZ, the chemoreceptor trigger zone and the emetic center of the brain. So you have acetylcholine, dopamine, histamine, serotonin, substance P, and that neurokinin 1 receptor that mediate these emetic responses, if you will, from our bodies. What happens right now in practice? Well, currently, most patients, if they're assessed to be at risk for postoperative nausea and vomiting, will receive 9 times out of 10 or more, they're going to get ondansetron or Zofran, which is a 5-HT3 antagonist. If they're perceived to be at higher risk, then they'll also typically get dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid, for their prophylaxis. But what happens right now is postoperatively, you get to see all this little, see what happens there? So what you're trying to do is there's no sound effects, so I have to kind of provide that for you. What happens is you need to really, because there's so many systems involved and so many receptor sites, it really does take a multimodal approach to effectively address it. But what happens most often after surgery, and here you can see from the, what do the guidelines say you should do? Well, one, you should assess risk. Well, what are the four major risk factors are? And you could probably tell from the hands that went up, female, non-smoker. So here, not being a smoker is a bad thing. Probably one of the only disease states, right? Non-smoker, former history of either post-operative nausea and vomiting, or if you get motion sickness, that either one of those two are a risk factor. And if you're going to get perioperative opioid treatment for your pain during that perioperative period. And so what the guidelines say is you assess the risk, and you should treat appropriately, both prophylactically, and you can see in the upper right-hand corner it says, look, if they're at medium risk, you probably need to use one or two antiemetics, like I said, most typically on ondansetron, which works on serotonin, and dexamethasone, which is a corticosteroid. But if they're at high risk, you need to have more than two interventions. And the important thing for us and where we're positioning our drug, as you can see in the fourth box there outlined in red, it says if you want to treat post-operative nausea and vomiting effectively, you need to use a drug from a different mechanistic class than the drugs that were chosen to be used prophylactically. It kind of makes sense. Remember those little drugs blocking the receptors that we saw earlier and I gave you the funny sound effects for? That if you've already blocked some of those receptors, using a drug that's going to try to block the same receptors that are already blocked is not going to provide much value. However, what happens, despite the treatment guidelines stating that, and despite the fact that the package insert for ondansetron right now contains this information right here that basically says that ondansetron works great unless you've already used it prophylactically. If you try to use it to treat after somebody's been dosed the drug prophylactically, it works worse than saline. But despite that fact, the vast majority of the time, patients are redosed with ondansetron in this setting. Why, you may ask? Because, look, there's a lot of antiemetics on the market. People look at us all the time and say, a new antiemetic, a new branded antiemetic? What are you doing? Well, the reason is you've got a lot of antiemetics, but they all come with a good bit of baggage. Either they don't work really well, and they also have some safety issues, as you can see from the chart here. So what you, in the guidelines, as we said, say you need to use a drug from a different mechanistic class. And so in summary, around the disease state, and this will play into how we're positioning, you can see there's various pathways involved. Despite the fact that patients are prophylaxed, there's still a lot of PONV that they experience. About a third of patients still experience it postoperatively. Right now, the 5-HT3 mechanism is what is used predominantly, and because of that, it doesn't really offer a great option. In fact, it might as well give them placebo postoperatively. And droperidol, I'll talk a little bit about droperidol. Anybody familiar with that drug? So it was the antiemetic of choice if you go back a decade, maybe a decade and a half ago. It's a dopamine antagonist, and it worked really well. They loved it. The problem was it came with a little bit of side effect baggage in that it prolonged the QT interval in the heart and ended up getting a boxed warning from the FDA. Once it got that boxed warning, it really fell out of use, and today it's very, very, for the last several years, it's been practically impossible to get droperidol, and it's simply one of those medical legal issues that hospitals don't want to stick their neck out on the line for. So, ta-da, Baremsys, this is where we come in. Our drug, which we are anticipating, as I said, next Friday, hearing from the FDA, some positive news that we're all looking to go celebrate with a margarita, being the Cinco de Mayo that it will be. Or at least it will be on Sunday. Our drug, Baremsys, is a very selective dopamine 2, dopamine 3 antagonist that's formulated as an IV for administration. This is an overview of our clinical trial program. Essentially, we did four positive pivotal trials. We had two in prophylaxis, two essentially in treatment, There were an additional two supportive trials in prevention. We did, because of the history with droperidol and many other dopamine antagonists, we did a thorough QT study to ensure that, you know, we could not fall victim to the same issues that they fell victim to, as well as because ondansetron itself also can prolong the QT interval, we did a study where we dosed the two drugs together in combination, and a clinical pharmacology study, radio-labeled drugs. So there have been about 2,000 patients in our program. Yeah, I was talking to somebody earlier, and we were talking about their company is basically looking at repurposing some a previous drug for a new indication. That's basically been our way of bringing drugs to market. That's what we've done as far as our development is concerned. And so this drug has been available, used chronically for psychosis at much, much higher doses than what we're doing here. So we've got, and we've been able to leverage the safety data and the pharmacodynamic data, pharmacokinetic and dynamic data that are available on the drug that it's been in use for decades in Europe. And so the good news is when you're able to develop a drug like that that already has that history of safety, the FDA isn't as worried that you're going to be the next Vioxx come with a surprise. So that's been extremely positive for us. This is basically an image of what the packaging will look like. Again, we're anticipating hearing some positive news here in a couple weeks, in which case we will immediately go to raising some more money and then hiring our sales force in earnest and anticipate launching this drug this summer here in the U.S. If all goes according to plan. Probably the most asked question I get from investors, from people I meet in Europe, from people I meet in San Diego and everywhere else is, why Indianapolis? Why are you guys in Indianapolis? Well, you heard Brian state some of this earlier. One, there's a lot of experienced folks in commercialization of drugs, regulatory, medical areas. You know what else? We're centrally located in the U.S., so it's not such a chore to get out to. When we worked in San Diego, you know, people in New York were like, oh, we'll come see you, but God, I got to cross the whole country. It's easier to get to us. We are, obviously, this is a much more affordable location. Our offices in San Diego were many-fold more expensive than where we are right now. So when you think about the other centers, Boston, San Francisco, San Diego, New Jersey, New York, this is a very, very attractive place, not only for the cost, but also the quality of life for employees that we're looking to attract and retain, cost of living for them, et cetera. But really, if you want to know the real answer to the question, why Indianapolis, it really has to do with the gentleman that I'm about to introduce and bring up. It's because Scott lived here. That's the simple answer. And essentially, the backstory on this is when we were at Cadence, we were looking to build out our portfolio. We had a product, IV acetaminophen, Affirmiv, which is a drug for perioperative pain. Basically the same space, same targeted customers. This is all targeted to anesthesiology and surgery. And we were looking for drugs to complement the drug that we had in our portfolio. And so we were looking at Acacia Pharma as a potential acquisition target. And that's how Scott got to know the folks, Julian and the rest of the folks on the team. And eventually, he went to work for them after we were bought by Mallinckrodt. I continued to grind it out with them for another year or so, and he called up and said, hey, Mikey, would you consider moving your family back to Indianapolis? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I just moved out to San Diego. And as a matter of fact, someone was asking, you know, did you have kids in school? Yeah, we had a couple kids in high school. And so it was an easy move for us to come back, put the kids back in the same high school. But essentially, it was Scott Bird that ended up causing us to be founded here in the, or at least established here as the U.S. operations here in Indianapolis. So Brian, should I bring him up? Or Scott, if I'll turn it over to Scott with Outpost. He's the reason that we're here in Indy. So good friend and colleague.
Okay. I was just told I get as much time as I would like. So, Mike, sorry for changing the timing on your slides so you had no idea what you were presenting next, but we thought it would be a good idea to do that without your knowledge. I'm looking forward to seeing what you did to mine. So this is going to be maybe the most inauspicious start to a presentation I've made and maybe you've ever heard, but I'm just going to start with, we are the pee and poo company, okay? So Mike apologized for talking about nausea and vomiting. I'm not going to apologize. My goal here is to get you excited about pee and poo by the time we leave the room today. So I have a pretty tall task ahead of me, but we have some neat, we do have some neat things to talk about. In fact, just the order of presentation today is a lot like my career. You know, I started in the commercial space at Eli Lilly working with monoclonal antibodies and acute coronary syndrome, really hot, neat space to be in. Then moved into small molecule and cardiovascular and then left and went to work on a 65-year-old drug, acetaminophen, and then went to work on nausea and vomiting. And now my career is all about the toilet. And so this is exactly where the opportunities lie for us. And I think, you know, what's interesting and maybe a little bit instructive is as excited as this industry gets, as maybe sometimes investors get, and certainly the press gets about really cool new gene science or immunotherapy or Alzheimer's treatments, there's an awful lot of good that can be done in the less sexy areas of healthcare. And in fact, if we take my non-Lilly experience and as well as Mike's at Cadence as an example, we went to go work on this drug that's been around, and you all know as Tylenol. Typically, you're treating your kid's fever with it in fairly low doses. Most people aren't using it for pain, at least over the counter anymore, but a few of us still do. Our task was to go out and launch this 60-year-old drug for the treatment of acute pain post-surgically. All right, this is about the worst pain that most people are going to be dealing with in their lives, and it certainly wasn't obvious to us this was going to be, at least most of us that ultimately went to work there, is going to be a big opportunity. It certainly wasn't nearly as sexy as some of the programs that Lilly, Big Pharma, and even some of the biotech community had in place at the time. But even by the time, in about 3 years from the time that I got there, and then we ultimately sold the company to Mallinckrodt, we were about a couple years post-launch, 1 out of 7 surgical patients in hospitals in the U.S. were getting IV acetaminophen. It's probably a little bit higher than that now, and I would argue by the time it goes generic in just a couple of years, probably about a third of people in hospitals getting surgeries are going to be treated with IV acetaminophen. The primary objective, of course, is to avoid opioids and all the consequences that come with that. Not super sexy, really basic science, but there's huge opportunity for improving healthcare. There's equally huge opportunity for financial reward, as many of our venture investors found out when we sold the company to Mallinckrodt for about $1.5 billion. It's a great side benefit. It's not the sole purpose for at least us on the management teams to be around. We really like going out and improving healthcare. And, you know, I get asked a lot why Outpost. The short version is because I kind of learned my lesson with Cadence and also with Acacia about the opportunity to come in and have an impact in areas that most people are not rushing into. With Outpost, we are a urology and a GI-focused company. We are split between Indianapolis and the UK as well. We're on the other end of the development spectrum from Acacia. They're getting ready to launch. We're really just on the front end stages of R&D with our two programs. We have two programs. I'll talk to you a little bit today about them, although I'm not going to get into any of the science. One of the advantages, we're still a private company, of being a private company is we don't have to disclose all of our secrets to everyone else and give them a head start on us. And in particular, we will and are competing with a few big pharma companies in this space. As you can imagine, they have a few more people and a lot more resources than we have. So we're going to stay under the radar and a secret, at least scientifically, as long as we possibly can or until we have to go out and tell our secrets to raise money. We have a lot of readouts coming in the near term. We do hope with the Series A funding that we've raised to date to be able to get to some critical milestones or from a venture perspective, some value inflection points. So generate some data with both of our programs that are going to get investors excited enough to come back and invest in us again and allow us to go into late stage development. Brian showed a slide earlier about the venture investing over the last few years. We've been very, very fortunate to have as good a group of venture investors as really one could ever hope for in the industry, from Fraser Healthcare, which is the founding venture firm of Outpost. Our two founders, Tachi Yamada and David Sox, are both venture partners at Fraser. But we also have Novo, Vivo, Adam Street, Takeda. I mean, this is, like I said, about as good as it gets. There's a few others that are up in that echelon, but not too many. We've raised $71 million in venture funding so far and another $15 million in venture debt. We're quite well funded relative to a lot of, if you will, startups at our stage, particularly here in the Midwest or in Indianapolis. Largely that's because it costs a lot of money to do the type of R&D that we are engaged in. You know, Acacia, for example, in the acute care space can spend a few million dollars and generate a lot of clinical data because the trials are very brief and therefore fairly inexpensive, whereas ours tend not to be. These are chronic conditions that we're dealing with. And I'll talk to you a little bit about them, but I won't promise not to get too graphic, and I definitely promise not to do any sound effects. That's not going to win me any friends. But we have, as you'll see in a moment, we've got deep expertise in the space. And I think that's one of the critical elements, not only to why Indianapolis, but to why Outpost and why we're going to be successful. We have, as I mentioned, both offices here in Indianapolis and in London. The why Indy piece, Mike already really gave the primary reasons other than my physical presence. Here in Indianapolis, my relationship with Fraser and others, I was asked by the Acacia board, I was asked by the Outpost board when I came on to join the companies, why Indianapolis, right? Or are you sure you can pull this off in Indianapolis? And I had absolutely no hesitation then. I have even less now that we can build successful biopharma companies in Indianapolis. There are a number of great exits that Brian shared with us earlier. That have occurred, but you know, beyond the success that we're looking to create with Outpost and the commercial success that Mike's going to be generating, you know, I think particularly with this room, I jumped back into this space again after our acquisition from Mallinckrodt, not just because I like the work, but I think there's an opportunity for us to build some traction and create a sustainable biopharma community here in Indianapolis. And we get a lot of early starts and then exits. But part of that, I think, is going to be convincing the folks, not just that are here in this room, because you probably already have interest, but the folks maybe one or two degrees removed from you that have grown up like I did at Lilly and had amazing training and development in that organization, but have drawn the conclusion that's the only place to be in biopharma in Indianapolis. It is a phenomenal company, and it's done great things, and it's developed great people. But I think most folks would be shocked how much impact one can have when you get outside of a large organization. You know, I look at the room now. There's a few folks that I know that have previously worked in a big companies now are helping us out with Outpost and have sought me out to tell me just, in fact, how much how they've been impressed by the amount of impact they've been able to have in just a few days in working with Outpost as opposed to sometimes the years that it might require in a large organization. Now, we also have a presence in London. There's two reasons for that. The primary reason is that's where some of our scientific talent has been based. They had previous experience on some of the assets that we have in the company now. But the other reason, and this might be instructive for the policymakers both in D.C. and also here in Indianapolis, we get a 30% tax credit for all of our R&D spend based out of London. So as a small company, what that means is you're not getting the promise of paying lower taxes later. We spend $100 million in 2018. We're going to get a $30 million check back from the UK government in 2019. So that's a pretty big incentive to create some efficiencies and to headquarter or do a lot of your work out of that geography. I don't think that it would be ideal for us to have all of our organization there because, of course, still most of the opportunity in this space is in the United States. We want to develop the expertise and the talent here as well. Our organization is much smaller than Acacia's, and we're not growing quite as fast, but we are having some nice growth. I just want to put this up, most importantly, to share with you some of the background and the talent. Tachi Yamada, one of our co-founders, is about as preeminent as it gets in GI. So he was former president of the GI Association here in the United States. He literally, his name is on the textbook that all gastroenterologists are trained on, former head of R&D at GSK, Takeda, ran the Bill and Melinda Gates Healthcare Foundation. He can get stuff done, incredibly bright, incredibly helpful for us. He's my chairman and provides not only great just general strategic insight for the organization, but you can imagine technically as well, he's got some horsepower to provide for us. But he's not the only one. We've got other folks like Ian Mills and Gordon McMurray, both trained at Pfizer, MD, PhD from Ian, MD, PhD, or the equivalent in the UK from Oxford and Cambridge. Dr. McMurray, former head of the neurology science group at Pfizer, also trained and ran labs at Oxford. This is about as good a group as you can get for an organization the size of ours. And the evidence of that is our first asset we actually licensed from Takeda. It's not up here. It was called OP233. The company was founded on this asset. It was focused on, much like our second program, 352, on stress urinary incontinence. And if that product failed in the clinic, that happens in this space. The question is, how do you react to those, both scientifically and organizationally? In this particular case, the venture syndicate that I mentioned before decided that, well, what's scarce in this space? Money's really not that scarce for venture biopharma. Assets are definitely relatively scarce, but even more scarce than the assets are really talented management teams. So before, this is before my time, I'm not tooting my own horn, but what happened when our first product failed is this syndicate decided to reinvest in the company as opposed to the typical approach would be you fold up shop, you pull your money back together and go find something else to do. They reinvested in this management team and went out and find new assets, the two that are on the screen here, for this management team to work on. And that gives you some sense on exactly how important the talent is to our industry, particularly the small startup biopharma space, and why the question comes so frequently, why Indianapolis? And I mentioned that my confidence has grown because we've had phenomenal access to talent. I'm not going to put up the slides of exactly the who's who, but we've hired 60 years of experience in the space over the last year. I've got another 20 or 30 years that'll be coming on board here in the next month or so, and then we've got access, at least on a part-time basis, as I look around the room, to another, I don't know, 60, 70 years of experience. All that here in Indianapolis, and I think it gives us a unique position to be able to move forward. You know, I am moving my slides, Mike, so when you see a mistake up here, it's my fault. So this is about as deep I'm going to get into the science. We've got two programs. The first, OP-687, we are evaluating for use in overactive bladder and irritable bowel syndrome. We have proof of concept data for both indications. So proof of concept, for those who might not be familiar, is essentially we have clinical data in real patients that shows that the drug has the impact on the outcomes that are important for that particular indication. For OP352, we have proof of mechanism data and some proof of concept data for the class. We have proof of mechanism data for the actual drug itself. In fact, some of the best data that's been generated, and the only drug that's ever really been proven to work in stress urinary incontinence, also came out of Indianapolis. Yentrive, duloxetine, Cymbalta at Lilly, they ultimately decided not to submit the drug for, well, they decided to pull their application for approval here in the U.S. It is approved outside of the U.S. in a few markets. But the beautiful thing about duloxetine is it's given us a clear path on how to have some effective treatments in stress urinary incontinence, and we're building on that knowledge with OP352. So we're just coming out of animals with OP352. We'll be going into humans here over the summer and entering our phase one with OP687. We're just coming out of our initial safety and PK studies in humans and going into phase two to demonstrate with this asset the effectiveness that we saw in some of the single center studies and some of the multi-center studies with the base drug. Now, I'm going to move pretty quickly through the next set of slides, but the message here is there's some really big opportunities. I mentioned earlier that we're not going to talk a lot about the science, again, because I don't really want to give the really, really smart people and much smarter people than me in this room any ideas on how to compete with us. We've got our work cut out for us enough just getting good science done. Competing against folks with a few hundred more billion than you is not, it's not a good strategy. At least it's not a very sustainable strategy. OP687 we licensed a few years ago. I mentioned we've got really great data both. It's a prodrug, so it's a drug that in order to be active has to be metabolized by the human body. There is great data with the base active agent marketed by another company, not in Indianapolis, but also Big Pharma. And they've proven that this works, although there are challenges with dosing with the active agent itself, and there are some great advantages primarily around the duration of the effect that you can get from using a prodrug in these particular disease states. And so that's the approach that we're taking. Overactive bladder is something probably many of you have seen commercials about or have family members that have dealt with. About 1 in 10 people, at least 1 in 10 adults, are dealing with this problem. There are a number of treatments out there in the market already. We will be effectively positioned as a treatment for refractory patients, patients that are not being treated adequately by the current drugs and generics. However, in irritable bowel syndrome, another massive disease. In fact, probably I get more reaction when I'm at cocktail parties and mention that we're working in irritable bowel syndrome than any other topic that I might raise. Of course, I'm surrounded by a lot of people about my age, late 40s, early 50s. That's about the time you really get a full appreciation for irritable bowel syndrome and what a problem it can be, all the way from very inconvenient to really a terrible, terrible thing to have to live with every day. There are very few treatments available, none of them very effective. We believe we've got a treatment that can not only help with the bowel symptoms associated with irritable bowel syndrome, primarily the diarrhea, but also, and more importantly, the pain associated with it, which is why folks seek treatment. The pain, unlike maybe the acute care space where they really need to avoid the nausea and vomiting, the pain is what drives folks to the doctor and what they're complaining about most of all. Isn't this a lot better than an actual photograph of these same body parts? I think we're going to stick with these. The original imagery, I was told, may not go over well and certainly won't help you raise the next $100 million. OP352 is, if you will, a more novel program. This is a unique chemical entity. There's only one drug that's ever been approved in the class, totally outside of urology and gastroenterology. Yet we think that there's not only application for stress urinary incontinence, but urge incontinence or mixed incontinence. So effectively gives us an opportunity for an all incontinence pill. Fecal incontinence, you know, not something anybody really ever wants to think about, but by the time you're, if you make it to 80 or 90, you will be thinking about it. And it's the number one reason folks are admitted to long-term care facilities today, and a massive, massive problem. We've got great proof of mechanism data in both spaces, as I mentioned earlier, and we're really excited about where this program can take us. Now, before I get to this particular slide, there are probably another 4, 5, or 6 indications, even outside of urology and GI, for this particular asset. So we are really, really excited. I'm going to show you some numbers on how big we think the market opportunity is just in urology and GI. That pales in comparison to where I think we can go with it long term. So for those of you who don't know much about incontinence, there are different ways you can have it. Stress incontinence, which is what we're talking about primarily with OP352, is leakage or incontinence that's associated with coughing, sneezing, laughing, you know, those sorts of issues that you hear a lot about. Much, much more common in women than it is in men, particularly after they've given birth to a child. There's some opportunity there to improve sphincter contractility, which in fact is how duloxetine works. That's the primary mechanism for the improvement in care there. We think we're more effective based on the preclinical models than anything that Dulox or the other similar agents have been able to produce. There's really nothing out there to treat them. That's the message on this slide. The treatments that are available are basically up to the patient to figure out. Pelvic floor muscle training, changing of their diet and habits. Nobody does that. I think we all can agree on that. I'm perfect evidence of it myself. All of the healthcare problems I have are my own problem. Yet I would much rather take a pill to solve the disease, and I think we have an opportunity to help folks get there. Fecal incontinence, this is something where it's really, really hard to get our arms around how big the opportunity is, but what we do know is that if you have it, it's a very big problem. It doesn't take frequency. Any occurrence of this is going to be an issue, right? I think all of us can pretty much agree on that. So about 1 out of 7 people are dealing with this right now, and that creates a massive opportunity. And like I said earlier, it's the number one reason folks are institutionalized as they age. So you can imagine the opportunity. I mean, 70% of folks are dealing with this at some stage in their lives. So we think it's an opportunity worth pursuing. Now, I put this slide up here with slight hesitation, but we have adjusted the opportunity numbers down to be about as conservative as we can be if the drug is effective. So everything, when you do forecasts, which is what I grew up doing at Lilly, making promises, et cetera, if you're going to be on the hook for delivering on them, it's worth your while to put some conservatism into these numbers. And what this represents is effectively the level of opportunity available for this drug and the indications that we're currently studying if we're no more effective than the treatments are for overactive bladder. It's the most comparable space that we can find out there. So overactive bladder is urge incontinence or urgency, even if you don't have incontinence. So we're somewhere for each indication looking at opportunities in the U.S. alone of about $1.5 to $2.5 billion a year. Overall, if it works for all of them, we're looking at a $3 or $4 billion a year opportunity here in the U.S. That's why we're able to go and raise $20 million, $40 million, $70 million to do the work. It's a high risk. There's obviously not a lot of success stories in this space, but there's incredibly high return and reward on the back end. So if you're not excited about pee and poo at this point, hopefully you can be at least excited about Outpost. We have some great assets that we're working on today. We're financed to achieve critical milestones with both of our core assets, 687 and OP352, over the next 2 years. We've got a great leadership team, and we're evaluating new opportunities. So if there happens to be anybody in the room that's got some neat new urology or GI products, I've got a whole pocket full of business cards I'd love to hand you. And from there, I think we can go on to whatever panel discussion. If we've not run out of time, I'm probably about 20 minutes over based on Mike's presentation. But
no, you're great. We're ready to go.
All right.
Thanks. We're good. If you guys could take a seat real quick. Appreciate that. That was really wide-ranging discussion because of where the companies are at. I'd like to throw out a few questions here early and then would love to get some dialogue here with the audience. I've seen we've got several, lots of veterans, lots of people who are in the industry and I know are curious to know the kind of the inside scoop on some of this. So, Mike, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. You know, as I was thinking about it, it seems like there's quite a bit of a challenge that you have to go through with, you have to build a team to be ready to go.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're working through some uncertainty with the regulatory body. Can you just talk about some of what's been the biggest challenge or just a few of the things that you have to deal with as you're thinking about your path to market, your achieving the goals that you want to achieve?
Yeah, sure. Good question. I think, you know, some of the biggest challenge in particular, if you're someone with a personality like mine, is finding other really good people to come along and work alongside you.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I was able to overcome that challenge and found a great team of folks. And as I said, you know, if you think about it, any organization going from 1 to 40 to will be 100 plus here in a year to a year and a half's time, that's probably the biggest challenge. As Scott pointed out, as I talked a little bit about, the great thing is in this area, we're able to tap into some great resources here in Indiana, folks that, you know, cut their teeth at places like Lilly or Elanco or other places. And you know, you got good, hardworking, smart, intelligent, salt-of-the-earth people to tap into here. I think, honestly, that's the biggest challenge. Of course, we're always, like you said earlier, you never have enough money. It's always good to have more. And that's honestly, that's the other thing that at least Scott hasn't really had to struggle with. But I know, you know, we as a startup company, it's always, you know, getting that next round of funding and getting enough to be able to sustain the growth and do the things that that we need to do to be successful. So those are probably the two biggest challenges, people and money, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate you'll be going to public markets to raise money?
So, yeah, we did. Last year, we went public on the Euronext exchange in Brussels, and we raised, dollar-wise, we raised $50 million. Mm-hmm. And we anticipate getting our approval and then going back out and doing another round of equity funding here.
Okay. Scott, I'm curious. Lots of folks in the room are going to know this, but we constantly have this discussion with the media, with people who may be less familiar with the way pharma works. Can you talk about kind of why a lot of what you're doing is going to be is virtual, and what do you think you'll keep inside versus outside as you, let's say, through the next 18 months?
Great question as well. Listen, I think the whole industry is moving to a virtual model at some level, and this was starting to happen 25 years ago at Lilly. And you know, even big pharma are looking at functions within the organization that could be executed more efficiently and more effectively outside of the company. Whether that's because there's a technical reason or knowledge for that, or because, like Lilly, they evolved from an antibiotics company to a diabetes company to a neuroscience company to a cancer company. And some of the talents are fungible, not all of them are. So doing clinical research is a great example. That tends to be a heavily therapeutic-focused expertise, being able to find, attract, and then study patients with particular diseases. And so for those reasons, Lilly goes to CROs, Pfizer, everybody's moving to that model. We are as well. Now, it's almost by necessity that a company like us becomes virtual. We don't have the built-in infrastructure that Big Pharma does, but what I've learned both from the early days at Cadence with Acacia and now is that really almost all of the hammer swinging, for lack of a better term, the doing of the work is probably best done by folks with bigger infrastructures and expertise that they can carry from company to company or drug to drug. What you need to own, and certainly what we're trying to own, are the folks that can help manage that work and talent and make the really tough strategic decisions or to interpret complex data. And so as you can see from the Mike slide and even from our own network, I'm trying to surround myself with the best scientists mm-hmm. that are available out there. That is our key to any of our success. Beyond that, there are some core functions that are primarily focused on managing these external partners that we're bringing in-house, whether that's CMC manufacturing, or it's regulatory, mm-hmm. Or it's some more administrative or commercial work. We are building those functions and organizations, but it's really with the focus of getting the work done through strategic partners. And I look around the room, I mentioned earlier, I see three or four folks, five maybe actually, that Outpost is working with here in Indy that are providing that talent to us, but not necessarily as employees.
No, that's great. Yeah, we have that discussion a lot with the state economic development agency, with the media, with other stakeholders that, you know, essentially many employees and a lot of expertise may not be inside, but it doesn't mean they don't exist in Indiana. They could be at Catalent. They could be at Cook Pharmica. They could be at a lot of places. I said the same one there. Catalent, Covance, there's, I think, 45 CROs or CMOs in the state. So.
Well, I mean, just in the last year, I've had some learning about what's the best way to even execute a virtual model. It's not necessarily to look all across the world for some one person that's got some expertise. Sometimes you have to do that because that expertise is very unique and you've got to go to wherever, India, China, mm-hmm. somewhere to get it. Ideally, I would like to have it down the street from me because that makes us more efficient and makes that engagement much more effective. So, mm-hmm. you know, to the extent that if I were in front of policymakers or media, we may not have a big employee base at Outpost, but the impact of the partnerships that we're trying to create really is best deployed here within the state mm-hmm. And even within the county.
Okay, that's great. It validates the things that we have tried, points we've tried to make with those stakeholders. So, Mike, I'm going to transition back to you real quick. I'm curious, and this is probably a little bit more my lack of knowledge of the space, but also as a trend, two questions. One, kind of who are your competitors?
Yeah.
You talked about some drugs that are on the market. And I would just ask is how is reimbursement? Are you having to do health outcomes data now? Will you have to provide that to payers later? Yeah. You could just talk about a little bit about that, the interest.
Yeah, absolutely. So the interesting thing is in our space, it's pretty much everything's generic, okay. At least in postoperative nausea and vomiting. There are some branded drugs, obviously, in chemo-induced nausea and vomiting. But in PONV, where we're launching, we're competing against generics. So the answer to your second question is yes. We do have to provide health economic data, and that's why you saw me spend a little bit of time on those slides talking about the financial impact to the hospital systems of post-operative nausea and vomiting. And for us, it's making a case in the hospital space to the pharmacies, to the directors of pharmacy who are managing their budgets and trying to, you know, have some sort of predictability. And what we have to prove is not only do we bring clinical advancement, but that clinical advance actually has a positive pharmacoeconomic impact, maybe not on the pharmacy budget, but on the system overall. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, that's where we're spending our time. And our competition is really, I don't know if it's competition, but the challenge is always, you know, getting the nod from pharmacy, getting the nod from the the IDN systems that are becoming more and more controlling of their members and those pharmacists that kind of run those P&T decisions.
Brian, just one comment on this for Mike, because there's something I think might be helpful to understand that runs counter to a lot of the press that our industry is getting right now. So obviously, I think everybody's heard about pricing in the pharmaceutical industry, the price increases, and frankly, the only place I think we can get support on both sides of the aisle and in D.C., which is to control pharma prices.
Yeah.
I think the counter to that, you know, what a lot of folks have done is they've marketed some novel molecules. They have been in positions where, in order to maintain their business moving forward, they've had to pull the price lever probably harder than what certainly the public would appreciate. What Acacia is doing, what Mike and his team are doing, is they've got this unbelievable technology that can dramatically improve care in the hospital setting for patients dealing with the worst issues post-surgically. And the positioning of this drug is only for those instances in which the patients have failed on the existing generics. And so, you know, here we have all this press out there about how the industry is really trying to take advantage of the market dynamics within the U.S. And what I think gets missed are companies like Acacia or even Cadence when we launched an $11 IV therapy into the hospital market. You can go out and have massive impact and create, I think, both meaningful drugs and meaningful companies without this approach where you're going to charge $1 million a year. Here's a great example where pharmacy, this ought to be a no-brainer for every hospital in the company to put the drug on formulary, because we're asking only for them to be treating those patients once their current technology has failed.
Yeah.
It's a pretty neat success story.
That's a good story, definitely. Before we transition out to having a few questions from the audience, Scott, I wanted to ask you, clearly lots of experience in larger companies, and actually it sounds like kind of they've gotten large and maybe gotten smaller as you've progressed through your career. What's been and that doesn't mean to say that you aren't entrepreneurial in a big company. Let me make sure I say that to my friends in the audience. But what has been the biggest difference, say, between Lilly and Outpost or Mallinckrodt and Outpost?
Well, some of this may be a Scott problem, not a big company or Lilly problem. But I think I look back on 20 years, and I couldn't say enough wonderful things. Wouldn't have had the opportunities I have now without the training I got at Lilly. At the same time, I spent 20 years trying to avoid making a mistake for fear that mistake would have pretty severe consequences on that next opportunity for me. The aha moment I had when I came to startup or biopharma was I don't have the same resources to avoid making a mistake anymore. You know, I didn't have a $70 million pre-approval marketing budget. My post-approval budget was $7 million, okay, at Cadence. And so we had to take a different approach and strategy. And obviously, I mean, I'm not going to get in. There's no bureaucracy in the small companies, which allows you to be much more effective, right? I think that's obvious, and everybody would expect that.
Right.
I don't think everybody understands what it means in their daily lives until you get into it. Mike once explained to me after the fourth time I offered him a job and he finally accepted and came on board, and I asked him why he didn't come. He said, well, it was trying to explain to a fish what it's like to breathe air, right? I had no context for what this life would be like, right? So that's definitely true, but the aha moment I had is that when we launched IV acetaminophen without all these resources, then the only thing that we could compete on was the talent of the folks that we had in the field. And I couldn't, my whole thesis for how do you run a hospital organization, a sales organization, was that you can't treat it like St. Vincent's is completely different than IU is completely different than community. Mm-hmm. The way they make decisions is much more about their structure and internal dynamics than it is about the fact that they're a hospital. And so you've got to decentralize decision making. And so our success came ultimately and sending a base plan out into our field. So they understood what our objectives were. They had the resources to go execute, and they went out and they tried things, and most of them failed. They fed that back into the organization. We learned from it, and then provided back out to the organization solutions that were working for the problems that they were all dealing with. Mm-hmm. That same dynamic is really easy to see in a sales force. We also had it in manufacturing. We also had it in our R&D organization. We had it in our regulatory organization. It wasn't as obvious to me there because I didn't have the depth of expertise in those functions as I did on the commercial side. But that's the biggest difference between a small organization like a Casey or Outpost and a big organization like Lilly is. You should be, if you want to be successful, selecting for those people who are competent enough to go out and make mistakes. Yep. And have the ability to then interpret them and share those so for the benefit of the organization. Once everybody gets rewarded for the same thing, right? You have a small organization. Everybody's bonus at Cadence was based on our performance as an organization. Mm-hmm. There was only one factor there, and that really focuses the mind and gets people engaged to solve the same problem. You can't apply that necessarily the same way in a big company, but I would say as people are looking to jump out of big organizations or to come into biopharma and you wonder if you can do it, if you're willing to fail, you can do it. And you have the confidence to be able to respond to that, I think both the organization and you will benefit greatly from it.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Well, what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes to field some questions from our audience here. Great set of people to talk with. They've been in the trenches, still in the trenches. So what I'd like to do is we've got a few minutes here. Try to grab a few questions. Does anybody want to be the first person to ask a question? Jim, thank you. Jim Schultz.
So how do you bring more of that East Coast, West Coast talent back to Indiana? What can we do to bring people like you guys back to Indiana to help boost that life sciences environment we've got here? Because, I mean, you're right, and we hear it in Boston, San Diego,
right.
San Francisco. Well, if you're not out there, bring back the Indiana people back to
Indiana? Just to throw that out real quick in case you couldn't hear it, the question is how do you get talent back to Indy if it happens to be in other places?
I don't know that there's a silver bullet. I'll tell you what we've done is leverage, to a large degree, leverage relationships that we have in place. You know, you meet people along the way that some people say become their people, you know, and you want to work together again. And that's how, to a certain degree, we've done it, or leverage their networks and whatnot. That's how we find them. But how do you get them back to Indiana? How do you get them to Indiana? I've got somebody in our organization right now that has been on board for a year. They live in Boston, and they've had to come, you know, commute back and forth. And they've been telling me lately, I think I could live there in Indiana. I'm about ready to get an apartment and move. I think, you know, once people get exposure to Indiana and they start looking at cost of living differences and, you know, a lot of the other amenities that you and I and the rest of us in the room have come to appreciate and enjoy, it's not so hard. But I think you've got to, first of all, find the talent. And I told you, we've got somebody who's in Boston and they're not here, right? You saw my org chart. I got 40 people and 15 of them are here. To a certain degree, what's important is what Scott said, is you got to find the right people. And he talked about in his example of, you know, the venture capitalist being willing to back the management team again. What I've found for us is you find the right people. You got to have a little bit of flexibility initially, but then the attraction of, you know, wanting to be around the rest of the team and seeing what life can be like in Indiana, I think speaks for itself. That's probably a very poor answer, but what are your thoughts on it?
No, not at all. My goal isn't necessarily to bring folks back to Indiana. To the extent that we are, it's folks that have ties already to Indiana. I think that's pretty consistent with the BioCrossroads initiatives as well. But I don't want a bunch of Boston folks or San Francisco folks in Indianapolis. I think we've created a culture and set of capabilities that are unique here, and we've got plenty of talent. And frankly, I just like to engage more of the talent that we've got already here. We're a decade or two away, in my opinion, from needing to import a whole bunch of talent. And, how do I attract folks from outside of our community of startups and small biopharma into that community. That's a lot bigger problem for me and what I'm focused on. And I think having some success makes that a lot easier. And I mean, you look at Fritz and Mike Sherman and Richard DeMarkey and others have had, they've really shown that you can be very successful here in Indy. But I think the other aha that folks need to have is once you've built that experience that really broadens your horizons in a small company and you end up having this impact far beyond your technical niche that you're forced into in large companies, for example, you're a heck of a lot more attractive to every other employee on earth or employer on earth. And so folks are afraid of making that leap out of big companies or established companies into small because they're really afraid of what's the next thing if something bad happens. Well, Mike's a perfect example. I mean, he came out to San Diego and we sold the company within a month or two of him moving. It was my worst case scenario after recruiting him for 4 years, but he has thrived through multiple companies post the, if you will, absorption of Cadence. And I think that's true for most folks that come out of big organizations into these mm-hmm. startups.
Yeah. Great. Oh.
Yeah, so it's, I have to be honest, when I wake up in the morning and go into the office, it's probably not on my first three or four things to work on and think about. We do have, my daughter is graduating this year. She has been very interested in Butler in the health sciences organization here. And through those conversations, I got exposure to talent that I had no real full appreciation for at Butler specifically. The same thing is true at some of the other unnamed universities here in central Indiana. And we talked about in some of those conversations about some really neat pharmacy intern or project roles that we would love to get some support from. So yes, is a short answer. I don't have a program, and we don't have an infrastructure to have a formal program in place, but we do have really tough problems to solve. And so that's usually the basis for some great projects for these folks, these really bright young people that can go in and pour themselves into it over a fairly brief period of time. So yes is a short answer.
We actually have a full-fledged internship program.
Wow.
Really?
We've had one intern.
Business card. Grab it.
No, I'm teasing, but we did have an intern this past year. She happened to be the daughter of one of our employees. And I think, you know, the business benefited from it. We weren't, like Scott said, we weren't like waking up in the morning looking for how can we find some intern help. But the business benefited, and I think she benefited from the experience as well. So, yeah, we're open to it for sure, and I think that we could do a better job of tapping into the talent that we have available. We brought someone on recently who used to teach pharmacy at Purdue and is very connected with the program up there, so that we've been looking into how could we potentially do some things to bring some more interns in that both of us could benefit from. So, love to talk to you afterwards.
Okay. Let's take one more question, then I get the final question.
Looks like you might get the final question.
Looks like I might get it. Okay. Well, we're getting ready to wrap up here. I just want to know, just bluntly, what kinds of roles are you hiring? You're both growing in different ways, different speeds, but what are you looking for?
We're probably we are at different ends of the spectrum, right? So commercially, we are in the process of hiring Salesforce. Mm-hmm. We have hired out most of our internal support here in town. Of course, as we grow over time and as we move towards our indication in chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, et cetera, there'll be some additional supportive roles. I think we have a sales analyst role internally here in Indy that we'll be filling probably the next 4, 5, 6 months. We're hiring 60 sales reps, and there's a couple of other roles that we could see adding over time. But Scott, I know you're on the other end of the spectrum. What do you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I got two answers for you. One in terms of full-time employees, the other in terms of, if you will, partners or consultants or contract folks that we aren't quite ready to bring on full-time but need desperately some talent and help from. On the employee side, we are searching for a head of regulatory and quality assurance at the moment. We're looking for folks in clinical operations, statistics, little bit further down the road later this year, quality control, CMC quality control, and supply chain operations, some administrative support as well. On the external relationships, as I mentioned, we've got 4, 5, 6 folks here in the room that we already have great relationships with. Beyond that, looking for some help on the commercial and new product planning side in like a week. So
okay.
Very near term. Yes, looking at you as well. Obviously, CRO expertise, but not just CRO in the traditional sense. There's a number of roles even helping us manage CRO activities that we're going to need help with. And most of those folks, my experience is, are already cold calling at me and emailing me. So
okay.
I probably don't need to do a whole lot of advertising based on my inbox for that. But there's a lot of roles that we're looking to fill. And I would say as we get through maybe about a year, year and a half from now, those number of opportunities will go from what I mentioned, 4 or 5 on the employee side to probably 10 or 12. And then at the end of our 2-year window, once we have established proof of concept and are ready to move into phase 2B studies, the larger, if you will, clinical studies, you know, we're looking at maybe another 15
okay.
or so folks beyond that. I'm not ready to be quite the Acacia size, but we do have some very, very specialized opportunities, and I'm more than happy to recruit from other large healthcare institutions here locally.
All right. Well, if you guys would take a moment and thank our guests here, this has been great. Just two more things. First of all, again, want to thank our sponsors, Butler University, Miles Printing, and Indy Science Connect. Two dates to put on your calendar. The next Indy Science Connect event is going to be at St. Joseph's Brewery. It's at 5th and College.
We weren't invited to that one.
Don't worry. I'm going to get you. I'm going to put you on. The best way to watch what Indy Science Connect is doing is to our LinkedIn page is Indy Science Connect. We've got close to 600 folks registered for that. And so far, you know, we're going to have roughly 75, 100 people at that event at St. Joseph. It's May 9th. It's Thursday, May 9th at 5:30 p.m. at St. Joseph's. And Indy Science Connect is really just an opportunity where we're trying to get folks who are on the academic side, PhD candidates, postdocs, really trying to understand and know what is here in industry, because only 1 in 7 PhDs are going to have a role in academia to be teaching or to be doing research. So we're trying to get those relationships built early so people just don't defend their thesis and then go, oh my gosh, there's nothing here. What do? I've got to go somewhere else. So we've had pretty good success at people connecting and finding some fellowships and finding full-time employment. So we'd love to have you guys there May 9th, 5:30 p.m., St. Joseph Brewery. And then finally, our next Frameworks event is going to be June 11th, and it's actually going to be at 5:30. It's going to be an evening event focused on innovation coming out of IU, Notre Dame, and Purdue. So anything else, Lori? Okay. Thanks for coming, and feel free to grab some coffee on your way out.
Excellent.